This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. There are more than 800 confirmed dead, and the death toll from Indonesia's twin disaster of a major earthquake and tsunami may end up in the thousands, according to officials, and the affected area may be larger than initially thought. We get more from Reuters' Rosanna Philpott.
Dozens there are reported to still be alive under the rubble of two hotels and a mall. One survivor told Reuters she narrowly escaped as the mall folded in around her.
I just finished shopping and went to the cashier. Suddenly everything got dark and the walls started falling around us. It was horrible. I rushed to a broken escalator with my daughters and we made it outside.
Authorities have confirmed grim images from Saturday of body bags lined up in the streets. Damaged roads are slowing down rescue efforts and the military is sending in cargo planes to rescue survivors. And that's just Palu. The wave struck a wide stretch of coastline after it moved in at speeds of 500 miles per hour. Officials are bracing for far worse accounts of death and destruction as outlying areas report in.
That's Reuters' Rosanna Philpott. The White House says a date has not yet been set for a highly anticipated meeting between U.S. President Trump and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the man overseeing the special investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. A recent New York Times report said that Rosenstein had suggested secretly recording Trump to obtain evidence to have him removed from office for being unfit to govern. Rosenstein has issued two statements flatly denying the allegations. The Global Security Exchange Conference was in the U.S. city of Las Vegas, Nevada. It's the site and timing of the annual conference are especially significant this year because it was held less than a week before the anniversary of the country's worst shooting by a single individual, that person, Stephen Paddock, who fired from his room at Mandalay Bay Resort. This is VOA News. With little time left ahead of a deadline to agree on a renewed NAFTA, that's the North American Free Trade Agreement, Canadian and U.S. trade officials Sunday tried to settle differences on tough issues such as protection against American tariffs. The administration of U.S. President Trump said Canada must sign on to the text of the updated North American Free Trade Agreement by midnight Sunday, or face exclusion from the trilateral pact, which includes Mexico. NAFTA underpins $1.2 trillion in annual trade and markets, and feared its demise would cause major economic disruption. Amid a new investigation of a Supreme Court nominee, U.S. President Donald Trump is maintaining his support for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, saying that hopefully at the conclusion everything will be fine. During a political rally in the state of West Virginia, Mr. Trump said the FBI is looking into the sexual assault claims against Kavanaugh, but ultimately suggests that Democrats are trying to sabotage Kavanaugh's appointment.
You see what's going on? You see this horrible, horrible, radical group of Democrats? You see it happening right now? And they're determined to take back power by using any means necessary.
Two women have claimed that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted them years ago, one in high school, the other in college, the FBI investigating. Macedonians are voting this Sunday on whether the country should change its name to North Macedonia to end a decades-old dispute with neighboring Greece and pave the way for the country's admission into NATO and the European Union. Nikola Dimitrov is Macedonia's foreign minister.
I hope that this will be a smooth democratic process, that the people will make the choice for our country to move forward, finally, towards EU, towards NATO, towards friendship with our neighbors in the region. We have an opportunity for the region to show that it can also produce future and not only history.
Athens has argued that the name Macedonia belongs exclusively to its northern province of Macedonia, and using the name implies that Skopje's intentions to claim the Greek province. Greece for years pressured Skopje into renouncing the country's name, forcing it to use the more formal moniker former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia in the United Nations. Tesla's Elon Musk will only be wearing the title of chief executive under a new agreement reached with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Under that agreement, he must step down as chairman, and Tesla and Musk must each pay $20 million in fines after the exchange said Musk misled investors with tweets about taking the company private. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
We do have 16.9% of fake people that has been registered into the system.
DRC opposition parties warn of an attempt to rig the upcoming December presidential election.
Nigerians must take ownership of the fight against corruption. And we must speak with one voice wherever we meet at the international forum. And we must insist that money stolen from our various countries must be returned to the owner.
The chairman for the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission calls on Nigerians to be part of the fight against corruption.
Ils ont assez distrait le peuple camerounais. Nous avons besoin de revenir sur ce qui.
He says beer has distracted Cameroonians for 36 years, and it is high time the people are told the truth.
Cameroonian President Paul Biya seeks re-election in the upcoming October vote. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Opposition political parties in the Democratic Republic of Congo plan to form an alliance in the run-up to the December general election. They also plan to choose a single candidate to challenge the ruling party coalition in the presidential vote. This after the parties held talks in the capital Kinshasa Saturday. They warned that the government may try to rig the December polls with compromised voter machines. The Electoral Commission rejects the accusation. For more about the opposition meeting, I reach Ibrahim Luakabwanga, National Secretary in charge of communication for the main opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS.
Two weeks ago, an international commission came here, led by Great Britain's institution. They conclude that this machine needs a lot of changes. So they came in with 19 points that has to be fulfilled by the Electoral Commission in order to use safely the machines. The second one was concerning we do have 16.9% of fake people that has being registered into the system. And the opposition until now have asked for the removal of those fake, can you imagine, it's almost like 10 million people.
But delivering a speech at the United Nations, President Joseph Kabila said that this year's election will be credible, peaceful, and transparent. Why is the opposition still kicking against this?
Yes, but you have to look at this point. Just as a reminder, I'll tell you that constitutionally, we should have had those elections in December 2016. So now we're almost 2 years after, and we are not sure that we're going to end up with a fair process. Not only the opposition is actually blaming the use of the machine, but also the MONUSCO, which is a mission of the UN in the Congo. So if some institutions or countries that are dealing with the Congo have some doubts with these machines, the people from the CENI have to understand, because legally, and this is a matter of constitutionally, there is no use of the machine for elections. It's been said into the schedule of the CENI that we should use only paper to vote. Elections, because we're getting organized on our side. What we just need is to be sure that those elections will be fair and transparent.
The chairman of the CNE said that his outfit, the CNE, will constantly engage with all political parties, including your party, to address your concerns in the run-up to the elections. Are you not satisfied with this plan?
That's just a talk, sorry to say so. We've been asked more than once to be able to take a look at the machines. My party sent 45 technical questions to the CENI in order to know exactly what type of software was running into the system. We had several important technical questions. They came out with answers that doesn't actually give us the real situation of the machine. And like I told you in the beginning, an international committee came in 2 weeks ago, and they conclude that the machine has a lot of a false system that can help, you know, for the treasury.
Félix Tshisekedi said that the opposition will remain united in the run-up to the election. Are there talks that you could possibly form an alliance, knowing very well that an alliance with one presidential candidate among all the opposition candidates will present a better chance of winning the upcoming election, as some of your supporters are saying? How do you address that?
Exactly. I think I forgot to tell you, this is actually one of the reasons why also yesterday we had to talk with during the meeting, and even the population, they came in asking us, you know, to be to get united. We assured them that we want to go to the elections. We will go to the election with one common candidate, and we have to work onto a program to make sure that the program will fit everybody, because we do have socialists in the opposition. We do have capitalists, you know, those who are liberal. So we have to find out a common ground with a common program. And commissions are already in place from, and the candidates have also already sent, you know, their technicians in order to work on that program. So we know, and it's going to be soon, maybe this week or the week after, we're going to come out with the name of the person who's going to be representing the opposition.
Abraham Luakabwanga is the National Secretary in charge of communication for the main opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS. He spoke with me from Kinshasa. Acting chairman of the Nigerian Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC, says citizens must join the fight against corruption. Ibrahim Magu also says Africans must speak with one voice to ensure stolen public funds stored abroad are returned. His comments came at a meeting in New York about the fight against corruption on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. For more about the meeting, I reach Ibrahim Magu in New York.
No, it is very important. The best strategy in fighting corruption is to mobilize everybody on board, Africans, then diaspora Africans back home. I said we should unite and fight corruption and defeat corruption. And we should speak with one voice before any international forum that we must insist that the money stolen from Africa must be returned to Africans. That's how far we have gone. We've resolved that we put it together in the fight against corruption.
So with this meeting, what is the next strategy to recoup some of these monies already stashed elsewhere from Africa?
No, we are already on course with fellow Africans, and we are on course with other non-African countries who are friends of Africa. And we are also working with a lot of countries like the U.S. with the DOJ and FBI. And in England, London, we are working with the NCA. We are also working with the Switzerland Law Enforcement Agency, with the Italian Law Enforcement Agency, and Mauritius, so many other countries. We are in league with them to chase corruption out and to repatriate back to the divided country the money stolen and hidden abroad.
Nigeria has had a history of some government officials stashing monies abroad. How is the fight against that corruption in Nigeria currently?
That is exactly what I'm saying. It has never been so effective like this before. And one of the deliberately designed and structured strategy in the fight against corruption this time around is to make sure we encourage investors into the country, because we have to lay a very conducive investment environment for investors to come in. And we are doing everything possible to encourage investors outside Africa or outside Nigeria to come back home and invest, and to encourage Nigerians in diaspora to also look back. And we are guaranteed that we are going to fight in all the corrupt practices, all the fraudulent practices going on here, because we will stop all this 419 or obtaining money under false pretenses. We'll give them back the money and ensure that justice prevails.
Talk to me about the fight against corruption in Nigeria, because some Nigerians have complained that a lot of allegations have been made against public officials who have stolen public money, and that the process of EFCC appear to be so slow. Do you think this assessment is justified?
What I would say in this respect is that let Nigerians take ownership of the fight against corruption, because we cannot ask EFCC alone or the government agencies to do the fight, because the enormity of the evils done in corruption is so enormous that no one person or no one organization can handle it. So that's why I said they should take ownership of the fight. We will try our best. We move forward. At least we are making a little progress. This year alone, from January 2019 to date, we have over 188 convictions. It has never happened in Nigeria. So it's a milestone. It's really a milestone that we are moving. And we don't have any apologies in fighting corruption. It doesn't matter. We are going to do it. We are committed in killing corruption, not to even defeat corruption. We want to kill corruption. And I assure you, with the way we are moving, we maintain the momentum. And just give us a few, 2-3 years, and corruption is gone.
Mr. Magu, let me ask you this. Despite the political will coming from the presidency, what about the other arms of government giving you the support that you need in this fight against corruption that you want to weed out or kill, as you said, in 2-3 years' time?
What you need in fighting corruption is the political goodwill. This is very, very fundamental. Any other thing you look, you see, we can manage any other thing. You have the political goodwill, and that is the infrastructure that is needed, that is most needed in the fight against corruption. And I am telling you, whether they like it or not, we will fight corruption to the last man, and we will win.
Before we let you go, Mr. Magu, your message to the people of Nigeria and the rest of Africa in this fight against graft.
We must work together. We must unite. Africa must be united in the fight against corruption. And Nigerian people must take ownership of the fight against corruption. And we must speak with one voice wherever we meet at the international forum. And we must insist that money stolen from our various countries must be returned to the owner.
Ibrahim Magu is the acting chairman of the Nigerian Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC. He spoke with me from New York. Cameroonian President Paul Biya says he has successfully pushed the militant group Boko Haram beyond the country's borders and urgently needs to be re-elected in the October 7 presidential poll so he can rebuild what was destroyed. Biya was in the northern town of Maroua in one of his rare outings from his presidential palace to launch his campaign ahead of the October 7 presidential vote. For VOA Moki, Edward Kenzeka reports from Maroua in the Cameroonian northern region.
Women dressed in President Paul Biya's Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM party attire, sing Saturday to welcome Paul Biya to Maroua. They are assuring Biya that they will vote for him to lead Cameroon in a new 7-year mandate beginning October 7. More than 30,000 people, ferried by the CPDM party from all over northern Cameroon, are present in Maroua. Biya's campaign photos can be seen everywhere in the town. Paul Biya tells them he has come to give his assurances of his love for the people of northern Cameroon.
Si j'ai choisi de venir en campagne chez vous à Maroua, c'est pour vous dire toute l'estime.
He says he has decided to visit Maroua as a sign of the high esteem he has for the people of Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, and because he wants to inform them of the new opportunities he will offer when re-elected. He says he cherishes the people of far north Cameroon because they resisted the destruction, burning and killing by the barbaric group Boko Haram. And now that terrorism has been defeated, it is time to create conditions for a return to normal economic, administrative and social life. Paul Biya said he will improve agriculture, start the exploration of what he said was the rich natural resources of the region and build a rail line to link North Cameroon and Chad to spur economic activity now that peace has returned and Boko Haram has been defeated. As Bia and his crowd of over 30,000 met at the Lamido Yaya Dairu Municipal Stadium, about 200 supporters of opposition candidate Maurice Kamto of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party, CRM, campaigned on the outskirts of Maroua. Yimgo Muhammadu, who leads the campaign rally, says Paul Bia was deceiving the masses. He says Bia has been responsible for the underdevelopment of Cameroon. He accuses Bia of not being sensitive to the needs of his people and hardly visits them.
Ils ont assez distrait le peuple camerounais. Nous avons besoin de revenir sur ce qui.
He says Bia has distracted Cameroonians for 36 years, and it is high time the people are told the truth and made to understand that Bia has not provided an enabling environment for their education, has not provided basic needs such as water, and does not pay civil servants well. He says Bia should be truthful to himself and acknowledge that Cameroon is in a pitiful state. Paul Bia, who is likely to win at the polls, has not announced that he will visit other regions of the country where there is or has been unrest. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Maroua.
The winner of this year's UNHCR Nansen Award, South Sudanese surgeon Ivan Attar Adha, says he will use the award's $150,000 cash prize to upgrade his ill-equipped hospital so he can save more lives. Attar will be honored for 2 decades of medical services to victims of war and persecution at an official ceremony Monday. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Evan Attar Adha and a team of doctors, nurses, and midwives work in Maban Hospital in Bunj, a town of more than 200,000 people in northeastern South Sudan. Attar says his hospital, which lies in the midst of a war zone, lacks even the most basic equipment and supplies. He tells VOA the challenges facing him and his team are enormous.
The resources from this award are going to really help us do better because we will obviously be able to get some equipment and some machines that we need, like an anesthetic machine, X-ray.
Attar says the team at Maban Hospital carries out an average of 58 surgeries a week, with only a single light in the surgical theater. He says electricity is provided by generators that often break down. The hospital itself, he says, has room for only 120 beds. This is not enough, so people sleep on the veranda, wherever there is space.
Our maternity is like 30 beds, and we are putting 2 mothers in 1 bed. So with this, if we are able to expand maternity, I'll be really so happy.
For the past 2 decades, Attar has provided medical aid for thousands of refugees, internally displaced, wounded fighters, and local communities at great personal sacrifice. He sees his wife and 4 children in Nairobi, Kenya, 3 times a year. Yet he says he has no plans to retire.
I will work for another 20 years. I think as long as I'm seeing, I am needed in the place. I will not go from there until make sure things are really settled at the end. And the only hope for that is actually peace. If peace comes to South Sudan and Sudan.
Nansen winner Attar tells VOA he will be happy when he is no longer needed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A large portion of wastewater is still being released into the environment without being treated, according to the United Nations. But in one of East Africa's largest informal settlements, an innovative wastewater treatment system is offering a simple, affordable solution to the problem. The system, which was set up in 2010 at Nairobi's sprawling Kibera slum, now provides clean water to thousands of low-income residents while promoting environmental sustainability and economic development. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
What are you here hearing is actually water that is being pumped up through the system. So these are up to rapid filters.
Known as the Human Needs Project, the initiative provides basic services such as clean water, sanitation, and energy to the residents of the informal settlement. Kibera lies on the outskirts of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, and is one of Africa's largest slums, home to more than 400,000 people. Lucia Monchere, a Kibera resident, is among the beneficiaries of the project.
So they started off by building a well, and then after that they decided to build the wastewater system, which is actually underneath. They thought of, instead of just providing water and toilets and showers to the people of Kibera, how about we comprise other services? That included the cafeteria downstairs. We have a laundry space where the people can bring their clothes in here. And then we also thought of bringing in empowerment programs, so we are able to teach the people of Kibera, and then at the end they're able to get jobs.
Another resident, Jacqueline Muyaka, a mother of two, says untreated water is a big issue among the slum dwellers.
These pipes na pito kama tondo tunakunywa hiyo maji. Na wengine nakuja safi, wengine nakuja ile kuna uchafu ndani ndio tunakunywa.
She says at times we get clean drinking water from the project, but other times we don't. The water is not always available, so sometimes we are forced to use untreated water from downstreams.
Mimi maji hata ikujangi kila siku. Mara imepotea na ikikuja inakuja na uchafu mingi, lakini inabidi tukunywe tujatuna mahali pengine pa kuchota maji.
Byron's Kahinga, the facility engineer, says the treated wastewater is safely disposed or used for other purposes. However, illegal water connections and leakages are posing health risks to the community.
At a break of a pipe, there's a lot of cross-contamination. The effects are waterborne diseases. We've had cases of typhoid and cholera around. So as much as we're in business for selling water, we're also looking at the effects of basically untreated water in the streams and rivers. When you're talking about a population of people that earn less than a dollar a day, any single cent that you can save is basically of use.
Meeting in Nairobi this week, environment ministers from around Africa committed to invest in innovative solutions in order to overcome environmental challenges facing the continent. To highlight the vital role that wastewater treatment plays in environmental sustainability and economic development, the participants toured the Kibera project. Barigai Lamizana Diallo is a program officer in charge of wastewater management at UN Environment. She says wastewater, if properly treated, presents a great opportunity.
We came to visit the Human Needs Project because it's always good to show that from wastewater you can have wealth out of it. And then one great idea and project can really change people's life. See how the Human Needs Project is integrated. The way they're providing drinking water for the community. The way they are also coming up with some training to improve their life and to change even their mindset on how they really can handle this big challenge which is wastewater, in this particular in Kibera.
She stresses that the right policies, technologies and financial incentives need to be put in place.
So there are countries like Namibia, for example, which is treating at the level that the treated wastewater is pumped back in the drinking systems. There are areas also where we need to do more. Need to do more, meaning that we need to invest in treatment technologies for wastewater, and we need also to enforce our policies and our regulation and standards we have well written so that the impact is.
The UN expert says water contaminated by bacteria and toxic waste, including chemicals, paints and heavy metals, is discharged into rivers, lakes and even oceans, with negative consequences for the environment and human health.
When you look at wastewater, there are so many things in this. You have pathogen in that. You can have heavy metals. You can have some chemical which is very harmful. So if it's not treated and it gets in contact of our food, then it's really impact on our health. Likewise, if it's running out and then in the environment, it's also impact our fish, our fauna, our flora, particularly in the settlement where the planning is sometimes not well done.
The UN Environment estimates that ecosystem degradation costs Africa $68 billion every year, coupled with losses of up to 6.6 million tons of potential grain harvest, capable of providing needed daily calories to 31 million people. Ruben Chama reporting for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, more people die from non-communicable diseases like heart attack, stroke, and cancer than any other group of diseases. The greatest burden of death is in low- and middle-income countries. As VOA's Carol Pearson report, world leaders at the UN General Assembly heard the leader of the World Health Organization propose policies that will save 10 million lives by 2025.
7 in 10 people worldwide die from cardiovascular diseases, cancer, diabetes, and chronic lung diseases, according to a recently published study in The Lancet. These diseases not only rob people prematurely of their lives, they cost enormous amounts of money. The Lancet report estimated that over the next 15 years, the cost to developing countries alone is projected to total more than $7 trillion. 3 years ago, world leaders pledged to reduce premature deaths from these non-communicable diseases by one-third by the year 2030. At Thursday's UN meeting in New York, WHO Secretary General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said less than half of the world's countries will meet that target, and he urged world leaders to recommit to these goals. Tedros called for more political commitment and domestic investment.
I know from my own experience that with political commitment, anything is possible. Without it, progress is slow.
Tedros mentioned a list of what he called best buys, policy changes that cost little but produce huge rewards.
WHO's best buys are cost-effective and affordable for all countries. Spending to build a healthier population is not a cost. It's an investment in human capital that pays a rich reward.
Tedros urged countries to increase tobacco taxes, restrict advertising for alcohol, and lower the amount of salt, sugar, and fat in food products. Doing this will lower the risks for diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and stroke. Tedros also advised countries to provide universal health coverage as the best way to prevent and treat non-communicable diseases. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, the Malawi Football Association president, Walter Nyamilandu, was elected to the FIFA Council at a special sitting of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Executive Committee in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, on Sunday. Nyamilandu defeated South African FA President Danny Jordan by 35 votes to 18 after two rounds of voting. The FIFA Council is the main decision-making arm of world football's governing body, with members drawn from each of the sport's regional confederations. The CAF position on the FIFA Council became open following the resignation of former Ghana FA President Kwesi Nyantachi, who was filmed by an investigative journalist appearing to take a $65,000 bribe from a supposed businessman. And the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has confirmed that Ghana will host the Women's Africa Cup of Nations in November as planned. CAF also confirmed that the 8-team Women's Nations Cup finals are set to take place from November 17th to December 1st in Ghana as planned, with Accra and Cape Coast scheduled to host the matches. The top three will all qualify for next year's Women's World Cup in France. However, Equatorial Guinea cannot play at the World Cup following a ban by FIFA for fielding ineligible players and for the use of forged and falsified documents by two of its players. The ineligible players were used in the qualifiers for the Women's Olympic Football Tournament for Rio 2016. Nigeria are the defending champions after beating host Cameroon 1-0 in the 2016 finals. The Super Falcons have won 8 of the 10 tournaments played so far, with Equatorial Guinea winning in 2008 and 2012. CAF also said a decision on whether Cameroon will be allowed to go ahead with hosting next year's Men's Africa Cup of Nations finals has been postponed until the end of November. Two separate inspection visits will be made in October and November to Cameroon, whose hosting of the finals has been in jeopardy for the last year since the decision to increase the tournament from 16 to 24 teams. On a sad note, Sierra Leonean referee Victor Amara died after collapsing while officiating a Community League football match in Freetown on Tuesday. The incident happened a few minutes before the end of a well-attended match between Crow Bay and Falcon 12 FC. Attempts were made to revive the 27-year-old, but he was pronounced dead after being rushed to hospital. The exact cause of death is not yet known. Mara took part in a CAF referee's course in Cairo just a few weeks ago. The course was the latest step in Mara's career that could have seen him eventually become an internationally recognized match official. Moving on to athletics, the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, says the agency has found no evidence of institutional doping in Kenya. WADA launched an investigation into widespread doping in Kenya in December 2016, focused on distance running. It found that 138 Kenyan athletes had tested positive for banned substances, 113 of them in competition between October 2004 and August 1st of this year. But WADA said there's no evidence of an institutionalized system. In a report released on Thursday, WADA said the doping practices of Kenyan athletes are unsophisticated, opportunistic, and uncoordinated, adding that doping in Kenya is drastically different from other doping structures discovered elsewhere in the world. WADA reinstated Russia's anti-doping agency on September 21st, ending a three-year suspension that followed a major scandal of alleged state-sponsored doping. Kenya athletes won 13 medals in Rio, 6 gold, 6 silver, and 1 bronze. Finally, pre-race favorite Lemmy Bahanu of Ethiopia lived up to expectations to register a convincing victory in the men's race, while his compatriot Waganesh Makash rallied to take the women's title at the Hangshui Lake International Marathon, an IAAF silver label road race in Hangshui, China, on Saturday. Bahanu clocked 2 hours, 8 minutes and 51 seconds, while Makash upset a strong field in 2 hours, 25 minutes and 57 seconds, a lifetime best. And that's about all the time we have for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
you are one and no. Sissy Ferrari, oh. Oh,
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. During the current session of the 73rd General Assembly, many African heads of state and government are participating. And in the first week of the customary general debate, during which member states explain developments in the country as well as on pressing development in the international system, many African states have already spoken. President Paul Kagame of Rwanda, speaking on behalf of Africa, made a brief, concise statement in which he spoke glowingly of positive developments being taken by African states themselves, particularly in the Gulf region. He was, of course, talking about the moves by the Prime Minister of Ethiopia to reconcile with Eritrea. The President of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, made a stout defense of African relationship with China without referring to the subtle attempts to discourage Africans' relationship with China. He noted that Africans are not worried about being recolonized by China. He then pointedly noted that those countries which are trying to warn Africa against China are themselves running at the present time towards China to make deals. He felt that the African continent needs China's support to rebuild their deficit in infrastructural development. All other African heads of state that have spoken have emphasized one crucial point: the need to reform the Security Council. For the last 20 years, Africans, as well as those from Latin America and Asia, have been calling on the Security Council to reform. Africa has demanded two new permanent seats as well as additional non-permanent seats. But what we have seen is that at least three United Nations Security Permanent Members are dead set against any reform meaningfully to the African and Asian and Latin American causes. The best they have done is to call for permanent seats to these regions without the right to vote. This itself is very, very strange because there is no reference in this charter to the right of veto. The right of veto comes from the permanency of the council members and not any right of veto added to it. In fact, in the first decade of the Security Council performance, the then Soviet representative abstained in the vote in the Security Council. He quickly added that abstention should not be taken as violating the Charter's requirement that for resolutions to be passed substantively, you need the concurrent votes of all the five permanent members. The then legal counsel of the Secretariat supported that interpretation. And later, when South Africa under apartheid and Portugal went to the International Court of Justice to challenge it, the International Court of Justice also endorsed the fact that abstention does not violate the requirement for concurrent votes of the non-permanent members. So Africa and the rest of us should reject any notion that they could have permanent membership without what now is called the right of veto. President Macron of France spoke about imbalances and inequalities in the international system that must be addressed quickly. Unfortunately, he did not speak about imbalances in institutions. For example, just mentioned at the Security Council, or the fact that institutions established in 1945, such as the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, still remain unchanged in the sense that up to today, the World Bank is to be headed by an American and the IMF by a European. There is urgent need to change the leadership in these institutions. Equally, in the case of the Secretariat, the Gentlemen's Agreement in 1946 in London, which gave the main departments of the Secretariat to the five permanent members, was changed by Dag Hammarskjöld in 1954. Dag Hammarskjöld felt it was not responsible to have that the five permanent members should also have the main departments in the Secretariat. He removed them and brought in small and medium-sized powers. Unfortunately, after the end of the Cold War and the late 1900s, 1990s, the Secretariat was reformed, and today the three of the five permanent members, Britain, France, and the United States, are now occupying the main departments of the Secretariat. And in the case of France and the DPKO, peacekeeping, they have held that post for 20 years. That is unacceptable. All these matters should be addressed. Finally, Africans should point out that to maintain international peace and security, such inequalities are not conducive to international stability. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you don't show an indigent the way to his or her own house. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During his travels in South America, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis called the ongoing tragedy in Venezuela a human-imposed condition. This is not some act of God, he noted. It's not something that just had to happen because it was a natural disaster. In fact, they sit on enormous oil reserves. They've got tremendous opportunity for their people. The United States abhors what the misguided Maduro regime has done to the once prosperous country. We stand with the people of Venezuela in the midst of the tragedy that's forced on them by the power-hungry, oppressive regime that has compelled the citizens to flee their own country, declared Secretary Mattis. President Nicolas Maduro has lashed out against and threatened neighbors who have pointed out the regime's failures. Maduro, said Secretary Mattis, should know that we do not solve our problems in this hemisphere in that way, and that we democracies will stand together in rejecting such bellicose language and the saber-rattling that is behind it. Simon Bolivar, a Venezuelan military and political leader who liberated Venezuela, Bolivia, Colombia, among others, from the Spanish rule, once said that the most perfect system of government is that which produces the highest sum of societal security and the highest sum of political stability. It was Maduro and his inner circle, said Secretary Mattis, that violated the liberator's proud legacy. Democracy, the rule of law, individual freedom, and human rights cannot be taken for granted, warned Secretary Mattis. It is important to remember this when looking at what Maduro has done to destroy Venezuela's democratic government. A key characteristic of a professional military is democratic civilian control. You see this in Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Colombia, observed Secretary Mattis. But you will not see it in Cuba. You will not see it in Venezuela. You will not see it in Nicaragua, where the military is used to oppress their own people and keep certain regimes in power, noted Secretary Mattis. As a bulwark against these repressive regimes, the United States is seeking to broaden and deepen cooperation with allies and partners committed to strengthening democracy and the rule of law in the Western Hemisphere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.